Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Monday, March the 4th. Today, we're going to catch up with our good friend, Richard Baer. Richard, of course, an old friend of our show and one of the founding members of the American Thinker. Richard, it's always a great pleasure to have you.
Thanks, dude. Nice to be back.
Thank you so much. Well, Richard, I think the justices kind of made our day today. They stole the topics today. Good topics, of course. The Supreme Court, and then here in Texas, closer to where I am, the appeals court ruled, at least for the time being, keeping SB4, which is the law that was passed, keeping that on the books. It's going to be on the books. I guess it's on hold technically until March the 9th.
Mm-hmm.
And then on March the 9th, it goes into effect formally unless the Supreme Court intervenes. So that's kind of up. We'll see about that. But anyway, so let's begin with the really big ruling, and that's the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Your impression, your reaction to that, Richard?
Yeah, I think everyone after the oral arguments was expecting that the Colorado decision by their state Supreme Court, which overruled a local judge who had basically said, no, you can't do this. I mean, you can't block him. There's no insurrection here. There's no basis for this. And the state Supreme Court, I think by one vote, a narrow majority, had overturned them. And there was no sympathy whatsoever for that argument during the oral arguments in front of the Supreme Court. And what the court decision did was, A, they reacted quickly because a large number of primaries are coming up in the next 2 or 3 weeks. So the potential disenfranchisement of a significant number of voters who could influence the selection of a candidate in a political party would have been denied. So they moved quickly. They moved unanimously. There was a little bit of debate within the nine with the issue of whether they did a little more than they needed to. I mean, the court basically decided the states have no ability to essentially rule on federal candidates based on insurrection against the federal government. But they also added that what would require, what would enable some action would be if the Congress got involved, and the three liberal justices, the three women, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, all said that that was unnecessary to get to that stage. And what was interesting is Amy Coney Barrett added as a short additional argument saying that don't concentrate on the fact that we're not completely agreed on every word we say. All of us are agreed on the basic decision here, and it's a 9-0 decision. We're trying to reduce the temperature, and that's what we see as a positive thing for the country. And that's kind of interesting to have that kind of explicit argument from a judge in the court. Sometimes Roberts has spoken in that way because he wants to build consensus, you know, have the narrowest opinion possible. But Roberts was part of the five justices who actually agreed with the broader decision on that only Congress can do this with an action. So it's a pretty sweeping victory, I think, for the Trump side. And for all the newspapers who were dancing in the streets, you know, as each additional state was throwing Trump off the ballot. I mean, you got to wonder, Illinois, the worst of all, they'd already heard the arguments in the Supreme Court. The likelihood that this decision was going to get overturned was very high, and yet an Illinois judge decided to throw Trump off the ballot this week.
I know. My reaction, I had three reactions to it that I wanted to share with you. My first one is, and I don't think this is an exaggeration on my part, that they may have saved the union in the sense that if you allow states to decide, then the 2024 election would have been Trump running in 27 states, mm-hmm. and Biden running in 20. I mean, it's ridiculous. That's not right. What a federal election's. So I think they may have saved the union by simply, you know, eliminating this. Secondly, I thought that it's fairness for, if you're going to say that someone is guilty of insurrection, at the very least, you should be able to say this court found him guilty of insurrection.
Right, right.
It's sort of like, you know, saying to somebody, we're not going to give you this job, or we're going to fire you from your job because of something you didn't do. I mean, it's crazy. And I find interesting, Richard, that was, you know, there were three judges in the Supreme Court of Colorado who were basically saying that, you know, how can he be guilty of insurrection? Nobody has found him.
Right.
So I think
the federal special counsel who's dealing with Trump's actions on January 6th and any other actions to block the electoral process from proceeding, that also is an instance of no charge of insurrection, but charge of misbehavior.
Right.
So they didn't go with what the charge would be in the biggest federal case concerning Trump, and yet somehow state courts are relying on what? Right. What kind of record? What kind of contested record?
Kind of leads me to my third reaction, that maybe the Supreme Court actually saved the Democrat Party. And what I mean by that is the level of insanity that you're seeing out of the Democrats, what they call Trump derangement syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have attorney generals, you know, saying we're going to keep him off the ballot because of insurrection, or up in Maine, there was another reason. And then this judge in Illinois, you kind of get the feeling that maybe, I don't know, I hate to put it this way, but maybe you kind of get the feeling that Democrats need to make an appointment with a psychiatrist and tell them to get Trump out of their heads.
Yeah.
Because it just seems, you know, this is insanity. And if I may say so, I think a lot of Americans are starting to see that.
Yeah.
But this is maybe going too far, Richard.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's interesting, some of the polls that I've looked at in the last couple of weeks, for the first time, you're seeing a not insignificant number of people who voted for Biden last time, Democrats who voted for Biden or independents who voted for Biden, who are now leaning towards Trump. So in other words, people who may have been in neither of the two of you, I can't stand either one of you, I want another choice, but forced with a choice between these two candidates, a greater number are more willing to consider a candidate they rejected last time than was the case in 2020. And I think that's in part because of this whole lawfare campaign. I mean, people in New York are obsessed with what goes on in New York. People in the rest of the country look at New York and they think the state's a psychiatric basket case. I mean, they see a decision to basically steal $500 million from Donald Trump's businesses in New York and bar the family from operating the business for 3 years for a transaction in which there was nobody who had any kind of loss. And the other side of the transaction said they'd be very willing to have more transactions with the same guy who supposedly cheated them and committed fraud against them.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, this is so true, because I wonder how many business people in the United States would love to have a bank say that they love to do business with them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, that's a dream if you're a business person.
Right.
But then also in New York, you may have seen this, where the attorney general is going after a Brazilian company over climate change.
Climate change, because they make meat. They produce meat.
And I'm sitting there saying, what's going on there? I mean, you have to wonder. But, you know, if you're a serious member of the bar in New York, you have to wonder what's going on, because businesses will leave if they're not leaving already.
They are. I mean, Andrew Cuomo, when he was governor, and except for being a little too hands-on, so to speak, he was a fairly effective governor and made a big pitch about New York as welcoming to new businesses. We want to be a new New York. In other words, understanding the history of what people viewed as an unfriendly environment. And now you have this, and anyone who conceivably could think of themselves as a political target now has to view their business entity as at risk. And that's basically un-American. I mean, the whole lawfare project, and you look at the range of cases from Jean Carroll to paying off Stormy Daniels, to this alleged fraud case with the Deutsche Bank, to the cases in Atlanta, to the federal cases. I mean, people look at this and they say, really, is Donald Trump so out of line in the history of all prior presidents that in the year he's running for office again, all of these cases happened to come due in the 6 months or 9 months before Election Day?
Right.
I mean, people can smell a rat and they see it.
And, oh, I think you're right. I think they can smell a big rat. It doesn't have to be a big rat. They can smell a little mouse here because this is really bad. Mm-hmm. And then the funny thing in D.C., they're going to be trying two cases there, and only 400 people vote for Trump. I mean, that's going to be almost – can you imagine anybody going to a jury pre-review or whatever they call it? Right. And the question is, are you fair? Can you be open-minded about Trump? And he's looking around the room and seeing who heard me say that. Right. I mean, so
– yeah, and it's not like New York is any better. I mean, the fact that they've already convicted him in the Ford case, you know, the judge did it there. But if you had a jury in New York, what do you think the demographics are in New York City, or especially in Manhattan? Probably 90% of those voters voted for Biden in 2020. Right.
No, you're right. And I think people are catching up with that. And that, I believe, is one of the reasons. My theory is that his comeback began when they sent the FBI into his home. Now, if you look at the polling data, you can see that he began to climb. Now, I agree with you that it really got, you know, better for Trump after this latest special counsel saying that Biden was guilty, but he couldn't. But he was too old, I guess, to go in front of a jury or whatever, exactly how he said it. But I just think they've gone crazy. And now you've got this case down. I mean, the case down in Atlanta, Richard, I mean, that's almost like a television soap opera. Yeah. I mean, that's silly and stupid. Yeah. And I honestly, I thought for a long time the best case they had against him was the document case. Mm-hmm. Because I thought there was a subpoena that he didn't respect and all of that. But that case now, after what they did to Biden and what they did to Hillary Clinton, I mean, there's no way the public would buy that, Richard.
Yeah, I mean, Sandy Berger went in and stuffed documents under his shirt and walked out with him during the Clinton years. Petraeus, you know, was talking pillow talk with his girlfriend about national security documents. So, I mean, if Trump, again, is the first guy to be assigned a prison sentence, it's one thing to plead guilty or to be proven guilty if they press charges against you and the case goes to trial. But assuming he doesn't settle and he's convicted, sending an ex-president to jail for documents he certainly had the legal right to review when he was president, as compared to some of these other people who, you know, took documents they never would have seen except for signing particular oaths every time they took them. And Biden having documents from his Senate days and his vice president days. These weren't documents, you know, he walked out of the White House with.
Well, what I remember, maybe you have a better memory than I do, but when I remember back in the Carter administration and late in his administration, when they implemented this program of keeping track of documents, so they created this agency. And the purpose of it was sort of like to keep track of documents, because I guess before that, there had been a little chaotic situation. But I don't remember, you know, when this came into existence, that they wanted to put anybody in jail. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was kind of like the library keeping track of books.
Right.
But not necessarily we're going to put you in jail because you have some documents. So I personally think the Democrats have overreacted to all these things to their detriment. I really do.
Yeah,
and maybe they've made a victim out of Trump.
His poll numbers rise every time there's kind of an additional malicious act against him by an attorney in, you know, some Democratic stronghold. And Fulton County is a Democratic stronghold. So obviously is Washington, D.C. So obviously is New York. So, I mean, there's not a lot. You're looking at Middle America has issued a verdict on Trump, and that's why these cases are where they are. I mean, the other thing is that these cases and the timing of them is something that I think really disturbs voters, because people can understand that he left office in 2020. January 6th was the very first days of the new Biden administration. You know, but Trump was still in office, but 2 weeks before Biden. So you're 3 years and, you know, whatever, a month later. All of these things are well back in time, and all of them somehow are materializing now. And then people just understand that this is an attempt to force the vote away from the candidate they don't want. You talk about Trump derangement syndrome. People who are swing voters are not people who are Trump derangement syndrome voters. right? They've decided they'll never vote for Trump, and they want him to go to jail. You know, they'd like personally to turn the switch in the electric chair, right, unless there's some more harmful way of executing someone. Right. But people who are swing voters are generally less engaged by politics, but they're being forced to look at these kind of things because they dominate the headlines. And they look at, and you have to think, they look at themselves and they say, is this normal? Right. What's more abnormal, the way Trump behaved? And yeah, there's a lot of abnormal stuff about the way Trump behaves. Sure. He's his own worst enemy in many cases. But seriously, does what he did deserving of what you're now seeing play out? And I think there's momentum coming out of this decision today. It'll make it less likely that the Democrats have success in other cases because of this decision today.
I agree. Now, one thing, too, that I was talking to a fellow from New York one recently, and he said, you know, this guy is 78 years old or 77 years old, something like that. And for the first 70 years of his life, nobody ever found anything wrong with him. You know, he did business in New York. I guess his father did business in New
right.
York. Now, you can always, again, with Trump, you can always, you know, you can always second guess the way he does things, the way he sure. talks, his style. All of that is fair game. But to throw the state of New York at this guy the way they have, and mm-hmm. it just, I think they've overdone it. And
yeah,
that's why
I
believe it's all coming back to haunt them. Let me bring up another legal case. And for those who are not familiar, the state legislature here in Texas passed a law called, the name of the law, SB-4. That's just, the way they filed that law. And basically it says that the police or the National Guard can arrest an illegal immigrant who crosses the state in open territory. I mean, if you go through a port of entry, nothing will happen to you. But if they catch you crossing the river or whatever and trying to sneak into the country, that you will be arrested. That law passed in huge numbers. It was signed by the governor. And the first challenge came. I don't know who the first judge is, but he came back saying that Texas doesn't have that authority. And then it went to the appeals court. And just today, the appeals court said, well, yes, it's okay. We're going to reinstate the law, but subject to the Supreme Court. So basically, the law will go into effect if the Supreme Court doesn't do right. anything by the 9th of March. Right. Now, I'm not surprised that the appeal court did that, Richard, because all that Texas is saying is that illegal immigration is illegal. And number two, that the federal government is not doing their part in this. And number three, they're claiming this invasion clause, which mm-hmm. to my knowledge, you may know better than me, but it's the first time I've ever heard any state do that.
Yeah, so, I think so. I think that's accurate.
So that's all they're doing. And to me, they found a winning audience in this Court of Appeals, which I should add, has always been a more conservative Court of Appeals. I mean, if you're a conservative and you want to win a case, take mm-hmm. it there. But right. that's where it went. So your reaction about all of this from up right. there?
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things is are the numbers involving essentially illegals who have entered the country. And the one number that no one really has a good handle on are what are called the getaways, not the people who are processed at a port of entry, who line up to get processed and then are given a court date 7 or 8 years in the future, by which time they're fully merged into the economy. They've had 3 American citizen children born here. And, you know, they're working illegally for some employer who never monitored their status, if they were approved or rejected for citizenship as a parolee. So that's one number. But the other number could be much larger than anyone suspects. And precisely because that the official ports of entry have been mobbed with these enormous flows, essentially the border agents have had no ability to really monitor all the other people showing up everywhere else and running through, a larger percentage of whom are likely to fall into the drug spreading, women for prostitution, criminal element. I mean, Venezuela, you know, seems to have found a way to reduce the expenses in the prison system, just, you know, opening up the jails and sending them to the United States. So this is,
if I may just jump in and say something about Venezuela, because this is really, I found this very interesting. About 6 months ago, I was talking to a couple from Venezuela. They're here through the asylum process. So they came in through a port of entry. And I asked them, you know, why are all these people coming? And this lady said to me, you know, among Venezuelans, there is a conversation that maybe the wrong kinds of people are coming in. That this is not, you know, mom and dad looking for freedom. This is, you know, a lot of people looking for trouble. And then just last week, I heard Senator Marco Rubio say the same thing, that there's talk in Florida of this. So obviously something is going on. Right. And many of these Venezuelans, as well as all these Chinese young men who are showing up. And I mean, it doesn't
smell even good. At the northern border, the Chinese are also coming in from the northern border into Maine, I read this week. But the Venezuelan community in Miami has been similar to the Cuban community. It's basically been an anti-Marxist community, people who fled because they didn't like the way the government operates. And now you're dealing with something new, because this has really been a very recent substantial increase in flows from a particular country, which the government seems to be interested in, because they actually identified Venezuelans as a group, you know, for whom they're going to allow certain number of tens of thousands every year under a new program. So it you know, when people start arguing that they're just bringing in voters, well, you know, it sounds a little bit over the top. You know, it sounds a little conspiratorial. But something is going on to have these kind of numbers. I mean, the president can be asleep at the switch, because essentially the brain is turned off sometime in the last 36 months and he has no ability to process anything seriously. And it really is humiliating for the country to have someone who basically people who meet with him walk out and they say he was reading from cards and he couldn't read clearly. He didn't know who he was with. He didn't know what war he was referring to. He mixes up Gaza and Ukraine. I mean, this is a kind of a shocking situation. I mean, Woodrow Wilson, you know, had this serious illnesses, and his wife effectively ran the country without anyone knowing. FDR was in very bad shape for many months before, you know, he finally died. But he had a large team of people who sort of knew his views and were running things. We don't know who's running things right now. But it's very unlikely to be the guy who's going to be the candidate for president unless Democrats force him out. And there's a growing evidence that the pressure is building there. I mean, Democrats have gone insane in the last 2 weeks since a recent New York Times poll, because they wake up every morning nervous that the Trump nightmare will reappear.
Right. Well, the other poll, too, that if I may bring up this one, I saw this one over the weekend. There's a CBS poll, too. That where people, if I understood it correctly, voters are recalling the Trump years favorably.
More favorably than they used to, correct.
Yeah, they're kind of saying, well, you know, gee, it wasn't that bad. Right. And that's what the price of gasoline will do to you, I guess.
Right. But also to what you said, which is that people are seeing Trump essentially as the victim. Rather than the perpetrator of crimes, they're seeing him as the victim of legal abuse by the federal government and various state or county governments. Yeah. And I mean, that's a kind of a shocking shift in tone, because it would have been hard to imagine that this would have occurred and led to what has happened. But his numbers have gone up after almost, again, every legal action that's taken against him. And since the decision on the documents by the special counsel Hoover, who has been attacked by Democrats as if he's an agent of the Trump administration, you know, because apparently 200 years back, some distant relative may have voted Republican once. But yeah. It's not a normal political environment. And the danger is, whichever candidate wins next time, there's going to be a substantial portion of the population which will view their victory as illegitimate. And the major reason for that is not because of what Trump did after Election Day in 2020, but the process that began when he got elected in 2016 with the Russia collusion narrative, which the Democrats and their supporters have never admitted was basically a setup from the beginning.
Right. No, I agree with you. I think that's one of my concerns, too, that if Trump wins, this is going to be...
Oh, it'll be awful.
Absolute madness.
It'll be madness.
I hate to... I hate to be the police officers who are going to be working on Inauguration Day, because it's going to be rough keeping the nutty people away. Well, one last thing I wanted to get into in the few minutes we have is, what are your polls or your gut feeling telling you about the U.S. Senate? I see some, obviously, West Virginia, that's a given. But I see a good candidate in Montana. I see a good candidate, this fellow Bernie Moreno in Ohio, could be a real rising superstar. So what are you hearing? I think Cruz will keep his position here easily. I think Scott will win in Florida. So what is your gut feeling about the race, the Senate?
This is the single best opportunity Republicans have had to not just take control, but win a real majority, you know, maybe 53, 54, 55, that they're likely to have in the next 10 years because of the candidates and the cycles. I mean, Manchin is a done deal, effectively, which brings the Republicans to 50. So if they can, in fact, hold Florida and Texas, which are probably not going to be blowouts, but Republicans will be favored in both races. Then you have to look at who are the vulnerable Democrats, and there are a lot of them. I mean, there are three right at the top. Ohio is one where Sherrod Brown has consistently won by 5-6 points. He has always sold himself as a Democratic populist, similar in some ways to Trump, not that far apart from J.D. Vance on some issues in terms of local control and working class appeal. That's always been his strength. And this year, the Republicans seem not to be having their demolition derby during the primaries. And so there's a chance that Moreno, who I think would probably be the strongest candidate and has some ability to self-fund, could give him a shot. You don't want to write off Sherrod Brown too quickly because he's a very experienced, successful politician. Montana is a state that Trump will probably win by 15 to 20 points. So the question is, how does Tester survive? He won by 3.5 points in 2018, which was a very, very good Democratic year. They took back the House in a big way. They picked up a couple of Senate seats. This year, the Republicans don't have kind of an out there candidate. They have a candidate who is a military veteran, who Trump actually did something very smart. He talked out of the race Matt Rosendahl, a congressman who lost last time. So I think Montana is a 50-50 race, which is pretty good when you got are running against an incumbent who's won three times. I mean, Tester is not going to go down easily. He has a lot of roots in the state, sort of like Susan Collins in Maine. Republicans shouldn't win statewide elections in Maine, but she does. Democrats shouldn't win elections in Montana, but he does. So those are the top two. The third one, which is a wild card, is Arizona, where Kristen Sinema hasn't really decided yet what to do, but the Democrat who is running for her place and willing to challenge her, even if she's going for it, is pretty hard to the left, Ruben Gallegos. And the Democrat is, the Republicans like to be Carrie Lake, who narrowly lost statewide. Now, she's a little bit of a divisive candidate, too. There's a lot of moderate Republicans there who don't much like her, who probably would vote for Sinema against her. But in a three-way race right now, it's pretty much divided, well divided, and all three of them are bunched, which is an opportunity. Considering the two Democrats running, a Republican should have a pretty decent shot. But there are other races, too, that are not dead. In Maryland, the Republican governor, Larry Hogan, who's probably the only Republican who could win in Maryland, is challenging an open seat Democrat because the Democrats retiring. So you don't have the power of incumbency, and other than maybe even the Republican, who is viewed as having won statewide before. Michigan is another state where the Democratic candidate is going to be a Jewish congresswoman from the state who narrowly won her House seats. And now, given the sort of craziness about the war in Michigan and the number of Democrats who are talking about boycotting the election because they think Biden should be pro-Hamas and pro-terrorism, and should, you know, change the party label from Democrat to jihadi, she is in a vulnerable position. Michigan is generally a state Democrats win. It's less of a toss-up state than Pennsylvania or Wisconsin or Arizona or Georgia. It's the most Democratic of those five. And yet, if Biden's in trouble in the state, Slotkin's going to be in trouble too. Who the Republicans nominate is not a laydown yet. Wisconsin is a possibility too. So you've got 5 or 6 possibilities for Republicans to start from a base of 50. They're probably not going to win them all, but they might win 3 or 4. And that would be a very good year, especially if they can hold the House, which is going to be close and is always close at this point, and win the White House.
Well, what's interesting to me is that we learned the last time around how important it was to have 53 or a majority, because there are probably going to be some Supreme Court openings. There's rumors of Sotomayor. I think that if there's a Republican president and a Republican Senate, my guess is that Clarence Thomas
might resign.
Well, yeah, might retire, because he's been there now for almost 30.
Over 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah, well, 91, right? So he's been there for a while. So I don't think he would do it with Biden, but if Trump was in and the Senate, he would do it. And so, you know, that at least would keep that seat in hand. But it would be fascinating. It would be fascinating if the Republicans were to pick up 53, 54 seats. The last time they did that was under Bush, as I recall. Mm-hmm. They had 55 at one point under Bush. But one last thing I'll say, though, this is a when you look at some of these candidates who are running, they're a lot closer to Trump than Bush in their attitudes. I mean, this is really a different party now.
Right.
And even myself, having voted Republican for a long time, I can see the difference.
Yeah, it's an issue because there are different levels of intensity in the support Republican traditional voters have towards various candidates. And with Trump, there's clearly still some holding back from a sizable share of what would be called the Mitt Romney voting support group. Back in 2012. So the Senate candidates in general, having somebody who's perceived as out there is not helpful in Senate races. I think Republicans have done a good job so far. Steve Daines has been running the selection process and has been successful, I think, in recruiting some top talented guys. I mean, I saw some people taking off on Larry Hogan. Mark Levin was... Craig was attacking him. Yeah.
Well,
as a
I'll take Hogan because it comes to the Supreme Court, we know how he's going to go.
Yeah, and, would you rather have somebody vote with you 70% of the time or zero? Right.
Exactly.
That's the choice.
But I'll ask you one parting question here, Richard. What do you think is more likely to happen, that the White Sox win the World Series or Nikki Haley drops out tomorrow night?
More likely than Nikki Haley drops out.
Oh, okay, all right.
Because the other one is zero. The other one's zero.
Yeah, no, because I kept wondering, how long is this lady going to go on?
Yeah, I think that, you know, she has demonstrated, you know, some support level, a decent support level within the Republican Party with a certain constituency that, exactly like we were just talking about, is not thrilled with Trump as their standard bearer. And I would prefer, actually, if Trump and his team laid off her a little bit and tried a different approach to sort of bringing her along. I think her bet all along has been that the legal troubles will eventually sink him, and that they'll then have to turn to somebody new. And she's, by sticking in the race and having gone around the country, would be the logical national replacement. I'm not sure that was a good bet, because the idea of Trump dropping out is similar to the idea of Biden dropping out.
Right.
They just don't want to drop out. But at this point, I think it would be helpful to have her in line supporting. I mean, it's always difficult to run a primary and lose and then back the guy who beat you. But I think it's in everybody's interest to get as many of her voters as possible for the Republican ballot.
No, I agree. Now, my own theory, we don't have a lot of time left, but my own theory is that the longer she hangs around, the less likely she would be to be nominated in the event Trump is out.
Could be.
I think that if, for example, this is just my theory, let's say something were to happen to Trump between now and convention time.
Right.
That would open up the convention. I actually think DeSantis has a better case. So she could actually end up hurting her future with the party. So let's hope that she drops out tomorrow night gracefully and says, I did it, and move on. Right. And I guess she will always be remembered as the lady who won the D.C. primary.
You're right, by the way. DeSantis is viewed at this point as the preferred alternative by Trump voters, overwhelmingly. So even though Trump bashed him, too, during the primaries, because that's kind of how it operates. You can't change him at this age. He is what he is. I prefer he wouldn't. I prefer he'd be a little more genial to people who are in his party whose support he needs. But it looks like Republicans understand Trump, that that's the way he is, and it doesn't really mean anything. And once he wins, and you know, if he was forced to drop out, they'll go to whoever seems the closest to him. And DeSantis is viewed as a tough guy because, yeah, you know, he stood up to essentially the other forces in Florida, and he's made a difference. He's been an excellent governor.
He has been. In fact, one of my questions for the next time we get together is DeSantis is VP. I think he would be actually – I know they got to settle
the double Florida thing. Yeah, that's an issue.
They got to settle, but they could probably do that. But just like, remember Cheney and Bush, they're both Texas.
Wisconsin, Wyoming, right.
Yeah. So they can work that out, but – I just think DeSantis would be a good VP choice. He brings a lot of things. But I want to thank you so much, as always, sure, for your input and for providing us with so much information. And I guess the next time we get together, I'll ask you about the immunity case. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm going to invite you soon. So
that's all right. Look forward to it. It's always fun.
Yeah, keep your calendar open, as they say.
All right, Silvio.
Thank you so much. Go White Sox. I hope they have a good year.
We get 70 wins.
70, so, well, you know, maybe 75 this year. But thank you so much, Richard. Have a wonderful day.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Our good friend, Richard Baer, gentleman I've known for a while. He was one of the founding members of the American Thinker, where I have the pleasure of dropping a few articles from time to time. But always a lot of information. We talked about the Colorado case. We talked about this appeal situation down here in Texas with SB4, and then speculated a little bit on the election, especially the Senate, which I'm very excited about. I think we have a chance to win the Senate. Thank you for listening. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you later. Bye-bye, everybody.